For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Here at Ancient Dragon Zengate, and I'm very happy that this morning we have, giving the morning talk, Paula Lazars, who's a member of our board and the secretary of Ancient Dragon. So thank you very much, Paula.
Thank you, Taigen, for giving me the opportunity to share my experience of the Dharma today. Most of the people that are here either practice Kung Fu with me, the people who practice at Ancient Dragon know that I'm a Kung Fu practitioner. So one of the stories that is always, that have always resonated with me on a very deep level is the story of Bodhidharma and what happens when he goes to China and how he accepts his first disciple, who is named Kwe Ka. So I'm going to talk a little bit first about Bodhidharma and when he lived. We know that Shakyamuni Buddha lived in the 5th century BCE, or what we used to call BC. So he lived about 8 to 1,000 years before Bodhidharma manifested himself on this planet. Bodhidharma was an Indian monk. And again, there's not very much known about him, and there's no proof that he actually lived. And any stories that are told about him came through oral tradition. There's no artifacts. There's a supposed grave, but there's no DNA. There's not a lot written down by him. There's not a lot written down about his teachings. So it's a compelling story because an amazing thing happened surrounding him and his visit to China, but yet there's hardly any kind of actual facts that he actually existed. It's almost like a vapor. And so you have to ask what actually happened that had such an impact around the world, even though there's no proof. So Bodhidharma was an Indian monk, well-versed in Buddhism before he entered China, and decided to travel to introduce a different way of practice to China. We know he was from India. He looked very different. The depictions of him are very different from typical Asian depictions in the sense that he had very long hair, he had a long beard. He's always shown with a lot of chest hair, leg hair, bug eyes, big eyes. So we know when he entered China, he was a foreigner. He was an alien. He was very different than the people that were there. At that time, China already was practicing Buddhism, and it was flourishing. There were thousands of temples with thousands of practitioners, so he felt that he had a different kind of take on it. But he knew he'd have to do something impressive to convince the Chinese that he had a different way. There are many different stories that surround his visit. I'm not going to talk about all of them. I'm just going to talk about him eventually ending up at what's called the Shaolin Temple. The Shaolin Temple was very close to the ancient capital of China called Luoyang, situated in a mountain range that is considered 5 sacred mountain peaks in China, where there were a lot of different Buddhist temples actually built along with Shaolin. Bodhidharma decided to park himself there But again, most of the people in China weren't that impressed with him. Everyone was aware he was there. So he realized he had to do something to make his mark. And what he decided to do is go up into a mountain, into a cave that was close to the Shaolin Temple. And he sat down and he faced a wall. So he sat in sitting meditation and he sat. And he sat. And he sat. And he sat. So the legend says that he sat there for 9 years. And it also says that he sat without food or water, without going to the bathroom. So again, this is a story and a myth. Now, whether this really happened or not, we don't know. But let's choose to believe, for the sake of the story, that it did. Now, eventually, the monks practicing in Shaolin Temple realized Bodhidharma was up there for a long time. And there was one monk especially who was curious. So he would go up there every now and then and visit him and see what was going on, kind of see if he was okay. And his name was Hui Ke. So he'd go up, and he'd go up, and he'd go up, week after week, month after month, year after year. Finally, somewhere in the middle of that, he was very impressed with the intensity and perseverance of Bodhidharma sitting, that he felt Bodhidharma had something that he wanted to learn. So he decided to ask Bodhidharma if he would accept him as a student. Bodhidharma, would you please accept me as a student? I think this sitting is amazing. I want to be like you. I don't understand how you could sit here without eating, drinking, or doing anything else. Will you accept me? And of course, Bodhidharma said, no. And this has all the trappings of a great Zen story, right? There's temples, there's sitting meditation, there's a monk trying to ask the master to teach him, and he's saying no. So everything about this is a stereotypical, you know, Buddhist Zen story and a stereotypical Kung Fu story. So he goes again the next week. Bodhidharma, will you teach me? No. And again, will you teach me? No. Goes back maybe 6 months later. Will you teach me now? No. So Hui Ke has a plan. He's just going to keep asking him and wear him down. So a few years go by, and this keeps going on and on and on in the course of this 9-year process. And finally, he asks again. And the seasons have changed many times. And it's at the beginning, it's at the end of fall and the beginning of winter. And Hui Ke is there asking his usual question, Bodhidharma, will you accept me as a student? Will you teach me? Finally, Bodhidharma says, no, but when the snow falls red from the sky, I will accept you then as a student. So Hui Ke is like, okay, I got a little more from him this time. The winter was just beginning. The snow was just starting to fall. And he decided he was going to wait for that snow to fall red. So instead of leaving and coming back and leaving and coming back, Hui Ke decided to just stand there. So the snow fell, and it went up to his feet. And the snow fell some more up to his ankles. And the snow fell some more up to his knees, up to his thighs, up to his hips, up to his waist. Up to this point, he didn't move. Finally, an idea popped into his head. As he looked to a tree, he saw a knife that was hanging from the tree that was used to prune some of the trees in the forest around the cave. He grabbed the knife, chopped off his left arm, grabbed it, waved it around. The flecks of the blood were falling from the arm, and because it was cold, they froze and they hit the ground red. And as he was doing that, he's like, Bodhidharma, Bodhidharma, look, the snow is falling from the sky red. Bodhidharma was so impressed with his sacrifice that he finally agreed to accept him as a student. And as the legend and story tells it, at that moment, the entire universe was so impressed by his sacrifice that the snow actually did fall red from the sky. So now again, this is an origin story for Zen Buddhism, and it's an origin story for Kung Fu. Even though Bodhidharma, all historians do agree on this fact, Bodhidharma never taught Kung Fu to anybody at the Shaolin Temple. So I want to look at what actually happened there, why it's an origin story for Zen Buddhism, or Chan, the Chinese call it Chan, and why it's also an origin story for Kung Fu, when actually no martial arts happened. First, we have to look at Bodhidharma sitting and the idea of him facing the wall. In ancient Dragon Zengate, we also face the wall when we meditate. The wall is a blank, still canvas. It's a metaphor for the stillness that we're trying to tap into when we sit in meditation. Tapping into the stillness, which Shakyamuni Buddha told us, is our original nature as human beings. So we have the wall and its stillness, and we have Bodhidharma sitting there for 9 years. Depending on the story, it was a little longer, actually, depending on who's telling the story. So again, he's there in stillness, tapping into our original nature, tapping into ultimate truth. Hui Ka finally realized that he needed to emulate some of this. So he decided to stand there and emulate that stillness. So once these two people actually sat in stillness, then there was a field for something to happen. Then there was an opportunity for something to emerge. But we know in our reality, let's say our conventional reality, our lives are not involved with just sitting and staring at a wall. There's a lot of activity that has to happen, and there's a lot of engagement that has to happen between a number of people. Hui Ka decided to act. He sat in stillness, realized his true nature, but he knew he had to do something. He had to completely engage in the process. So, metaphorically, let's say now, he chopped off his arm. What does that mean as a metaphor? Because we don't want to believe. Buddhism teaches us nonviolence. So we know being violent against ourselves is the number one no-no, because that's where it starts, right? You want to learn nonviolence against yourself. So we're going to say that this is a metaphor for something. The metaphor, first off, is his enthusiasm and his effort into practice. Okay, we know we can sit on our cushion and it's relaxing and enjoyable, but everyone here, I could say with full confidence, makes a commitment to do that at least once a week, maybe more. So without that effort or enthusiasm, again, nothing really manifests itself. So the cutting off the arm, though an extreme situation, it shows his commitment and enthusiasm for his practice. But now it gets a little tricky, because Buddhism also teaches enthusiasm is one thing, desire is another. So desiring to be taught, desiring for some kind of goal, we're taught in Buddhism, is a fast path to suffering. So the cutting off of the arm exemplified to Bodhidharma that Hui Ka understood engagement with non-attachment. I could jump into life in this moment, and I don't need to be attached to whatever that outcome is going to be. And this is an extreme example of being attached or being well-versed in non-attachment. Living in that moment, engaging himself to show his enthusiasm to learn, but knowing he could let go of that moment and live completely in the next moment. If we lose a limb, if we lose a sense faculty, and we know this practically, if somehow we have a terrible accident, we don't have an arm or a leg, if somehow we go blind, if somehow we get paralyzed, this is one of the worst things that could happen to a person. As we're sitting here thinking about it, I think we could all agree that none of us want that to happen to us. And we know, according to our culture, the only way we could live happily after that happens is that we have to completely throw away the life that we had, we have to accept our situation, and build a new life for ourselves without that sense faculty or without that limb. So Hui Ke's cutting off his arm was a metaphor for the fact that he knew how to do that. He knew how to have something happen, make a commitment, stay in the moment, and then let it completely go and let the next moment emerge as it will, based on the conditions he was in. It showed a faith in Bodhidharma's practice. It showed his commitment to knowing that whatever Bodhidharma was doing had more value than just this physical manifestation he was in at this moment. If we go a little deeper and a little more abstract with it, it also is a metaphor for non-dualism. In Buddhism, there's a concept that even though I can see Carla sitting across the floor over there, and she's there and I'm here, there's really no separation between us. And in ultimate truth, her and I are connected to each other. So, simplistically, we're trying to develop the sense of connectedness. We know it's easy with people we like, but the challenge for Buddhist practice is developing that connectedness with people we don't like, and then with nations we don't agree with, with actions we think are wrong, trying to understand our interconnectedness and culpability with all of it. With all of it, not just the parts that feel good. So in many ways, Hui Ke is speaking to the fact that even though he's losing an arm, he knows in his ultimate reality that arm is there. In our conventional reality, it was gone. But in ultimate truth, in ultimate reality, that arm was still there. And he showed his faith in that process. So there's a lot of things going on just there with him acting. But one of the other very important aspects of the story is this relationship that Damu and Hui Ke agreed to get into. Now I have to go to my notes. Weren't you happy when, did you feel a sense of happiness when Bodhidharma agreed to take Hui Ke as a student in your heart? This speaks to the fact that we like when people get together. We really like it, no matter what the situation is. So we have a whole entertainment industry based on people getting together to do things. And they get together through a lot of trials and tribulations, right? Whether the guy gets the girl or the guys band together and accomplish some kind of feat, or people get together and create a new society, or whether parents get reunited with a child, or we have a teacher-student relationship where the student becomes enlightened and lives a wonderful life. I mean, this story is told over and over again. So whether we believe it or not, we actually really, really, really like when people get together. Okay, so first off, Damu accepting Hui Ke as a student speaks to that happy feeling. We're glad that they got together. And this repeats itself over and over again in our life. This also speaks to the fact that there has to be agreement on both parties on what we're going to do. If I came to Taigen and asked him to teach me about Buddhist philosophy and concepts and to teach me about stillness and meditation, and if he did nothing but sat there like this, maybe something would happen, maybe not. But I need to get an agreement from him that he will walk this path with me. Just like we need agreement with the people in our lives that they're going to walk this path with us, whether they're fighting us or whether they're working with us, there's a certain element of agreement that we're going to engage in something together for reality to manifest itself. Buddhism also points to the importance of your own direct experience to realize the Dharma, to realize truth. Only by interacting with other people do we have a way of testing this realization. It's easy to fool ourselves that we're good at something, or we're enlightened, or we have some kind of wisdom, or we're very accomplished. But until we actually go out and test that against at least one other person, we don't really know if it's true. So the relationship points to an important aspect of Buddhism, is that you have to get in relationship to see if what you're experiencing on the cushion is real or not. The expansiveness, the touching into your original nature, the ability to let go as things emerge and stay completely in the present moment is really test very strictly and utmostly and to the nth degree when we're interacting with other people. Even though this is a very comforting place to be, and it could serve as a refuge, and it's important for it to serve as a refuge. But at some point, we have to go back out again, because none of us live up in the mountains, and even though they did, they still had to interact with each other. So how do we wrap this into our realistic experience on the relationships we have as lay practitioners? How do we know, have we ever felt this desire or thirst for knowledge, this desire to sacrifice something in the pursuit of knowledge or evolution? And we do see it every day in our different relationships and in the different way we express our lives. One very common way is when people have children. They sacrifice a lot to put that other individual first, and there's challenges that are rife with that relationship, but they're in it forever. Whether they have a lasting, friendly relationship or not, that relationship is manifest, and they're bound together forever. So we experience it in this way. People in different professions that make sacrifices, for example, doctors who go to school for, 10 or 12 years in residency, they're sacrificing a lot in order to get in relationship with patients, in order to realize some wider, expansive way of being on this earth, of touching into that same kind of thing that Bodhidharma and Hui Pa entered into. People who run into burning buildings to save other people, people who go to fight wars, they sacrifice themselves in order to plug into the larger idea that there's a better way for us to live. People who are on the front lines in very scary, dangerous physical situations are trying to plug into a larger truth. So there are many different ways that this kind of sacrifice and zeal and enthusiasm and coming together manifest themselves in our real life. What happened there feeds Chan for very obvious reasons, but it also feeds Shaolin Kung Fu, because without it, there is no entering into stillness and practice. All these different relationships I brought up, and Shaolin Kung Fu itself as well, are called Dharma gates. And Buddhism speaks to different Dharma gates all the time. And quite often, we get the impression that this is the only way to practice. But it's not. Any way that you're drawn to, any way your heart is drawn to, any way you feel your original nature manifests in the world, is, and any process you surrender yourself to, is considered a Dharma gate. So this story is also an origin story for Shaolin, because Shaolin serves as a Dharma gate to understand these concepts and to touch these concepts and to have experience of these concepts. Just like cooking can be, just like child rearing can be, just like practicing law can be, just like teaching in university can be, just like being a social worker can be. So the story also reminds us that whenever we find our true nature, practice stillness, and emerge from that to engage in the world, we're realizing a Dharma gate. And I think that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Paula, for really fine Dharma talk. We'll have some comments and questions and responses, but I want to put on my scholar's hat and add some footnotes to that. Just historically, I think even the academic scholars now admit that Bodhidharma actually existed. When I started practicing, I didn't. I remember Katagiri Roshi at Tassajara saying, they say that Bodhidharma never existed. In a few hundred years, they'll say we never existed either. There are some, I think, steles and stone relics that indicate that there was a Bodhidharma. So we don't. Well, there's lots and lots of stories. This is just Paula just told a little bit of that about Bodhidharma, and a lot of them are obviously fanciful. Another historical footnote, Weka, who became the second ancestor of Chan in China, apparently was missing an arm. But even early on, back then, they said he did not cut it off himself, that he met some bandits who did that for him earlier on. It's a great story, though, and thank you for showing its inner meaning to us. But I need to say as a disclaimer that everyone is welcome to come to Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. You do not need to cut off your arm. It's a sacrifice to just show up on a lovely Sunday morning and be here. So I appreciate that you're all here, but I just needed to qualify that. And the last historical footnote about Shaolin Temple. So I was there and climbed the mountain where Bodhidharma's cave was, right next to Shaolin. At the entryway, there's a whole bunch of martial arts. Has anybody else been to Shaolin?
Raise your hand.
A few of you have. There's this big statue of Bodhidharma, very buff, looking like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Anyway, and we saw some kids doing martial arts, and it was great. There is actually, though, historically, a really strong connection between what we're doing here and Shaolin Kung Fu. And this, some of you know, I talk about the Book of Serenity Koan collection a lot. It was started by a 12th century Chinese Chan master, Soto or Sado master named Hongzhe, and it was put together by a man named Wansong. So I'm sorry for all, there will not be a test, but anyway, he was a 13th century Chan master who compiled the Book of Serenity, wrote the commentaries. One of his students, and he was in the Sao Dong Soto lineage that we're in, and that was, it came to Japan at the same time as Wansong with a teacher named Dogen, who I talk about a lot and have translated. But Wansong had a student who became the abbot of Shaolin Temple. And he's the one who made Shaolin originally a martial arts center, because he invited, I don't know if he did martial arts himself, and I'm forgetting his name, Shui Yang, something like that. But he invited, Wansong's student, who was the abbot, invited martial art teachers from all over China to come to Shaolin, and that's when it became a center for martial arts. And he was in our same Sao Dong or Soto lineage. And his lineage continued at Shaolin. So what we do here, Soto Zen, is historically very connected to the martial arts aspect of Shaolin. So those are just historical footnotes. You can forget them, but I wanted to add that. And thank you again, Paula. And if anyone has comments or responses or questions for Paula, please feel free.
Can you speak at all to the relationship between the Shaolin Temple today and Zen Buddhism?
How much time do you have? I always equate it to kind of like the Catholic Church. There's always a lot of controversy surrounding it. The abbot recently, thanks to Raj over there, he sent me a link where the abbot was just in the news in China about an inner source kind of talked about indiscretions that they're accusing him of, whether it's materially or having a family on the side and all this kind of stuff. And the Chinese government is supposed to be weeding out corruption, so they're like, why aren't you weeding out him? Okay. And I'm just saying that to say there's a lot of controversy in a worldly way of whether he is a leader with a real Zen heart or not. Okay. But with a long history of Buddhism and with religion emerging again in China, he's made steps to introduce Zen practice again in a real way within the Shaolin Temple. In the 80s, it started emerging again as a martial arts center. He has been working hard to reintroduce very realistic and disciplined monastic practice back into Shaolin. But, you know, there's always a lot of controversy around it. Because of Shaolin Kung Fu, there's a lot of entertainment, there's a lot of money, there's a lot of tourism. He makes a lot of money, or the temple does, because a lot of it goes to the government. But at the same time, they build hospitals, they build orphanages, they've, you know, spread medicine, you know. So it's really something you almost have to research on your own and make up your own decision about. But even my students know I like to be an optimist, and people here at Ancient Dragon know that. And I like to accept the fact that we're all flawed as human beings. And I like to say that he's doing a good job reintroducing Buddhism back into the practice. I need to have faith in that. And if he's not doing it, we're trying to do it here. If he's not doing it, we're trying to realize it here. And that's one reason I appreciate having Ancient Dragon and having a place where I could experience some of that disciplined, devout, real Buddhist practice. Was that a kind of roundabout way to answer that? Anyone else could talk to that.
Anne, please.
In the beginning of your talk, you talked about Bodhidharma coming to China, and that it was already Buddhism was established there. And you say he had to do something to impress people, if he wanted to impress people. Of the Dharma teachers I know in Japan and here, I don't know anyone motivated that way. I mean, I think that didn't Bodhidharma just go there and sit, and then the guy showed up and wanted to be his disciple? Is he really motivated by trying to compete with something else? I mean, I hear little, in the States, little things about each other's temples and stuff, but I don't really see someone doing something like a meditative practice in order to compete with someone else, in order to impress someone else. So I, when you said that, I kind of was, wait a minute, what is this?
One thing to remember is that we have stories around events. Mm-hmm. So there are certain veins to that story where the competitiveness is introduced.
Oh, it's not your opinion that he was doing this. This is the story that he wanted.
I have no idea what he did.
Oh.
Okay.
But the story handed down is that he wanted to impress people. Is that right?
That's some people's story of it. Other people's are not, that he just went in the cave and sat.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's easy to just Google Bodhidharma, and you'll see uh-huh. hundreds of different takes on exactly the same story.
Yeah.
But what does that tell us about Buddhist practice? We all have our stories.
Yeah.
And we bring our stories to our practice.
Mm-hmm.
But ideally, we want to go deeper than all of those stories to find the ultimate reality.
So a more competitive person would read it as he went there to show them a thing or two.
Or someone who's averse to competitiveness might see a lot of competitiveness in it. Someone who's competitive might not see any at all. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I will say part of it, too, is cultural.
Mm-hmm.
You know, depending on what you know about Chinese culture, but it's an old culture,
mm-hmm.
5,000 years old. It's considered the longest established civilization on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
They're hard to impress.
Yeah.
So you might see it as not competitiveness, but even at the height, at certain dynastic points in China's history,
mm-hmm.
you needed to impress them for them to open their arms to you, because they were what was going on. Okay.
I'm going to comment, because I appreciated your question. Anne is a distinguished visitor. Oh, I'm sorry, Anne. She used to be the Ino at Tassajara. She's an old, young, but veteran Zen person. Anyway, but yeah, I had some question about the way you put that too, because the story in Zen, anyway, I don't know how the Kung Fu tradition is, but that he just went there and he actually avoided any kind of, he had this encounter, there's another story with the emperor, where he avoided any kind of recognition or awards or celebration. He just went off to the mountains and sat, because that's what he did. And then Weka noticed him. So anyway, there's different ways of telling the story, which is the point. These are all these stories, as Paula said, we don't know the exact history. We don't have any DVDs of, or you know, video of Bodhidharma sitting. So yeah, so we, part of our tradition is to play with these stories and see them from lots of different angles. So these stories are kind of family jewels, you know, that we can use to see different parts of our own practice.
You could probably tell I like to entertain people, so I'm just trying to make it a better story. Adrian?
Okay, so I don't know much about Buddhism except for nice conversations like this, so I'm going to fumble through this question a little bit. And it's more, maybe it's a little bit more theoretical, but we're talking about this, something that happened a long time ago, and in my personal religious beliefs, I like to apply these stories, whether true or not, into practicality of life. So I really appreciated what you said with, I guess, Dharma Gates, like somebody who's like a social worker or out fighting battles for us in real life. And is there anything within Buddhism, and you know, people have to come to those decisions on their own, as the story conveyed. So is there anything in the practice of Zen Buddhism that can bring enlightenment to people that maybe aren't getting it or aren't feeling that? Or because you see so many things in the world where, you know, we have these soldiers and they're doing these amazing trials and tribulations, and then you have people chastising them for that and criticizing them. So, you know, there are obviously people out there in the world that aren't finding that place of Zen. So I guess my question then is there anything within the practice of Buddhism that you do to like bring enlightenment to other people, like more broadly? I understand you're doing it in this temple, but is there any teachings that say like, okay, go out and like spread the word?
Okay. Yeah, okay. So Buddhism is one of the few religions in the world that doesn't proselytize. Am I saying that right? Okay. Say it again, Dave.
Proselytize.
Mm-hmm. And so there's not an evangelical side to it. And really, I'll speak from what it means to me, on how, and this goes back to Anne, right? This goes back to kind of what you're talking about as well. I feel the Buddhist practice I have is evident in the way I conduct myself, and people might be curious about Buddhism because of the way I conduct myself, but I don't need to tell them, you know, why I'm like this. It's kind of like there has to be a feeling when we come together in our daily lives that draws people to it, you know? And that's one thing I've always felt about it for myself, and it's been a long road getting to Buddhist practice. It's been a 20-year road. Sitting meditation was never it for me. So anybody who knows me well, this is very new to my practice. And it's only because I think because I'm older, and you calm down when you get older. But I've never been able to sit except for the past 5.5 years, and I tried. But I was exposed to Buddhist thought over 20 years ago, and it had an impact on my life by accident, you know. But I want to say, though Buddhism has precepts, guidelines, we like to say guidelines, not commandments, guidelines on how you should live your life. It does acknowledge the fact that in order to live the life according to the precepts, you have to really feel it in your heart. You have to be honest with yourself. It's not something that's put on you, or a container that's put on you that you bottle yourself into, you know, where other religions can tend to feel disciplinary. Like, if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen. Buddhism does not have that at all. So with it not having that at all, it also allows for all kinds of human behavior. It could, and that's why compassion and loving kindness is a very big aspect of Buddhist practice that we hopefully develop when we're sitting. That we're supposed to approach anybody, ideally, but of course realistically, we're all where we're at. Ideally, we want to approach anybody, regardless of what their role is in the world and what they're doing in the world, with a loving heart and compassion to listen to their story and to connect with them and understand why they're doing what they're doing. Because everyone has a good reason. Everyone has their story. You know, and that's why these stories are important. Everyone has a very valid story about why they're doing what they're doing. If we could just be still enough to truly listen to what they're telling us. So I think Buddhism teaches us to connect in this manner. But if you don't have the ability to connect to the stillness, it's very hard to connect in that manner within the activity. You're on.
Well, thanks for that. I'll just add, thank you, Paula. I'll add to that just that Zen Buddhism and all of Buddhism in Northern Asia, Tibet, India, China, Japan, Korea, is part of what we call the tradition of bodhisattvas, or awakening beings, enlightening beings. And we will chant at the end of this the four bodhisattva vows. But the underlying basis for this practice is to help relieve suffering, period. So, and there are many scriptures that talk about our practice is to help lead people, beings, to their own path to awakening, to seeing clearly, to that kindness and caring that Paula was talking about. So this is the basis for this and the other traditions that were in China before Bodhidharma came. Just that intention, not for personal liberation. So this is not a self-help practice. Of course, I know that many people I've seen, myself included, have benefited personally from the practice, and we have to be kind to ourselves first, as Paula was saying. But part of what we realize, not just intellectually, but viscerally through regular sitting practice, is how deeply connected we are to everyone and everything. And so then it's natural, it's just natural to try and be helpful. And how to do that is often really difficult. So we have to, as Paula was saying, slow down and quiet and feel that kind of ultimate context from which to respond to the people around us and in the world and to be helped, to actually be helpful. And that's not always easy. Sometimes there's nothing to do but just sit. And I think that's probably what Bodhidharma felt. That he wasn't going to do anything in China, but he was just going to sit there. And sometimes, I'll add one other piece to that story, that sometimes what he did is referred to as wall gazing, because he was sitting there looking at the wall. But in our practice, also wall gazing means the wall is looking at you. So we sit facing ourselves as well as the wall, not running away from our thoughts and feelings and allowing our humanity. So yeah, so we connect with others and be helpful in that way. And that's the basis of this practice, actually. Time for another comment or question for Paula, or response, anyone else? Alex.
I was just going to add to your question. I thought one concept that fits into that idea as well is Sangha. We talk about Sangha here as this community of practitioners, but we also talk about it as the greater world that we live in, and this whole community that we live in as human beings and other types of beings. And when you can bring your practice, just being who you are, your practice, because you're connected to this wider world, ultimately has an impact on it. And the more you are tempted into that idea of your practice, it influences everything around you, the people, everything that goes on within the world. So rather than a real direct, there is that too, but rather than a real direct, you know, kind of evangelical kind of concept of going out into the world and bringing your message, in my experience, it's been more bringing my practice, just my practice in and of itself, influences the world around me. And so I think that it's one way that Buddhism interacts with the rest of the wider world in a positive way.
Thank you. Yeah, the idea of song, the reality of Sangha or community is really important, and everybody here has their own combinations of communities, and this is how we express our practice in the world. And going back to your question, in our Sangha, where some of us are trying to find ways to do things together that are helpful in the world, but beyond that, many, many, many people in our Sangha, people in this room, are doing things in their lives in the world that are helpful, and clearly so, and are supported in that by coming together to just settle and feel this. Any last words, Paula?
I did forget. I wanted to read just a small thing in his teaching. Is that okay?
Yeah, please.
Okay. So this is all that's written about his teaching. That's it. And one page is in English and one is in Chinese, so there's not a lot at all. And he's using the word Buddha here as awakened being, not Shakyamuni, not the historical Buddha. Okay? To find a Buddha, all you have to do is see your nature. Your nature is the Buddha. And the Buddha is the person who's free. Free of plans, free of cares. If you don't see your nature and run around all day looking somewhere else, you'll never find a Buddha. The truth is, there's nothing to find. But to reach such an understanding, you need a teacher, and I'll replace that with, you need a relationship that acts as a teacher, and you need to struggle to make yourself understand. Life and death are important. Don't suffer them in vain.
So we'll close with the four bodhisattva vows, which are in the card you have, and we chant them three times.
Buddha's way is unsurpassable.